Hate is a commodity. It's as if it can be bought and sold, bottled up, exploited for profit. From political pundits going toe-to-toe on political roundtables to genocide that we see and read about a world away, we're taking a look at how hate takes hold in the forms it comes in and how we can work it out inside of our lives. It's The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Her book is called The Opposite of Hate, A Field Guide to Repairing Our Humanity. Author Sally Cohn is a columnist and political commentator for CNN. Sally, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me on. Very excited to do it. I'm a fan of your show.
So even though you pride yourself on being one of the quote-unquote nice ones, you admit that you found yourself occasionally swimming in hate, especially in recent years. Can you talk us through your personal connection to understanding hate?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if I get some award for being the nicest person by far. There's a lot nicer. I, though, think of myself as a nice person. Actually, I think most of us think of ourselves as nice people. And when I made the shift from being a community organizer for 15 years, which is what I did, I traveled around the country and Michigan and Montana and, Illinois and Idaho, helping regular people do what they were trying to do in their communities to make change, help them do it better, support them, and connect them with others to make bigger change at the state and national level. And when I made the shift, when I sort of fell into media, and then fell into, almost literally, being a talking head, a lefty talking head on Fox News, I walked in the door expecting that they would all be vicious, hateful monsters in the totalistic sense. So not just that I think their beliefs and their views are hateful, but there's that they would be hateful, like spewing venom at me constantly. I mean, really, I had these. And then two things happened. One, I realized they were complicated people who in some ways had hateful views, but in some ways were really, really nice and kind and supportive and friendly. And, you know, we could get along on different things or even agree on some policies. And then the other thing I realized was, oh my gosh, I hate them. Like, I came in here with all this hate and animosity and stereotype of who they were and two dimensions. And
oh, you had a lot of baggage.
Oh my God, and it made me want to understand, why is it we do this as human beings? Why is it we divide the world and the people around us into us versus them and habitually treat certain people, especially certain groups of people, as less than, which is what led to the journey of my book.
You also started this journey in childhood when you realized that you too had been a bully at one point.
Yeah. It's so interesting. I keep talking about this, but I don't, it still hurts every time. Because I feel, it sucks what I did. When I was in elementary school, I was a bully. It's funny, people are asking, I was just the bully. And in particular, there's a story I share in the book of a girl in fifth grade who a lot of kids picked on, even the teachers picked on, and who I really tormented in ways that, again, you know, and I make this point in the book that there's not, bullying and genocide aren't the same thing, right? I mean, that I argue hate exists along a spectrum, and we have to look at how they have common roots. So it's not an accident in the United States anyway, that most of the kids who are bullied in school are poor. Most of the kids are kids with disabilities, are gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgender, or gender nonconforming, immigrants, Muslims, right? These are the same kids who are getting picked on in schools who are being discriminated against in society as a whole. So they're related. And I had to come to terms with that.
So is hate then something that's innate for us as humans, or is there another explanation here?
So good news, bad news on this question. I was desperate to find research. I am not an unbiased researcher, so I was desperate to find the research that, no, in fact, we are not. I'd heard we're hardwired to hate, and I really wanted to disprove it. And it turns out we are hardwired to hate. Like, that's the bad news, right? And so now the metaphor that I think is most useful here is if we think about hardware versus software. So in fact, as human beings, as a product of our evolutionary biology and our evolutionary neuroanatomy, we have evolved a tendency to see our own group as good and feel warm, positive associations with our own group, and to have fear or even hate for others, those we perceive as others, strangers, etc. That is actually in the wiring in how our brains have developed. However, that's the hardware. The software is who we hate, how we use that hardware, and to what ends. And the software has been put in us, put in all of us, by our history, by our habits, by society. That is learned. That is coding that has been written over our history and encoded into us, and is still perpetuated by the media and culture and the ways we interact in our institutions and the bias in our police systems and our schools. And it's software. And we can undo it. We can unlearn it. We can change. That's the positive side.
Sally Cohn is with us. She is a columnist, political commentator for CNN. Her new book is called The Opposite of Hate, A Field Guide to Repairing Our Humanity. And you can join in the conversation at 800-642-1234. Where have you experienced hate in your own life? Have you engaged in hate, perhaps online or in real life, in your interactions? Where do you think all this hate is coming from? And is this necessarily a new thing? 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Tweet us at WPR Mornings. So, Sally, can you help us more with a working definition of hate? Because sometimes we don't even realize that the hate is there inside of us, that there is this perhaps bias that we don't even see. We're totally blind to it.
Right. So, the definition of hate as I'm talking about it, first of all, doesn't worry about, like, if you hate Brussels sprouts or broccoli. I happen to love both, but if you hate them, you can hate them. That's fine. I'm not going to judge you. If you hate Taylor Swift, I don't know why you would, but if you do, you don't like her music, that's fine. You can do that. You can even hate, in my book, you can even hate your ex-boss, your ex-girlfriend, like, fine, right? Interpersonal, that fine. Maybe we use a different word, but I'm not gonna go after you for that, right? What the kind of hate I'm talking about, the kind of hate I'm worried about, is the hate that is based on the history and habits of how we, as a species and as a society, divide the world into in groups and out groups, and tend to perpetually and severely demean and dehumanize those outgroups in ways that are lasting and consequential, and that also play out then in our politics, our policies, our institutions, our culture. So that, I should also be really clear here, because I am making some controversial assertions, that when I say that, you know, bullying and incivility online are hate, I'm not saying it's the same severity or even sort of a type as genocide and terrorism. They have the same root in this habit of dehumanizing and demeaning others. I'm also saying that there's explicit hate, right? Chanting, walking down the street, chanting racial epithets, holding tiki torches, explicit hate. And there's implicit hate. The study after study after study that shows that all of us who grow up in the United States of America have unconscious racial bias. We do. It's not necessarily our fault. It's a product of the history, the accumulated history, the sort of thumbprint of history and culture on all of us. And we have that, and that bias, again, it's not the same thing as explicit hatred, but they have the same root. And to not call it hate, to not call it a form of hate that is inculcated and insinuated itself into all of us, I think is being dishonest.
We're going to pause right there, talking about the hate that resides in us, how to become more aware of it, understand those blind spots, implicit bias. Sally Cohn, columnist and political commentator for CNN, stays with us. Her new book is The Opposite of Hate, A Field Guide to Repairing Our Humanity. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How do you wrestle with your own bias? Call in, email ideas at WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation after the news. CNN political commentator Sally Cohn set out on a mission to better understand hate and how to bridge our divides in society. A heavy lift for sure, but it's one that Sally Cohn takes through interviews around the world, around the country. We're talking with her on the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Her book is called The Opposite of Hate, A Field Guide to Repairing Our Humanity. You can join in the conversation at 800-642-1234. Where do you think all the hate is coming from? And is this necessarily a new thing? What do you think we can do as individuals to combat hate in our world? And what efforts do you make in your day-to-day life? Call in, tweet us at WPR Mornings. Paul from Eau Claire emailed a question, and that is, if hatred makes someone feel better, why shouldn't we indulge in that feeling? Sally?
Well, first question is, does it? Because it actually doesn't make me feel, there's only two people. I assume it doesn't mean makes the other person feel better, the recipient of the other end of the hate, number one. Number two, I actually feel like crap when I hate people. So I question that. There's studies, by the way, that show that hate, resentment, grudges, and hate specifically are bad for our health. In terms of our, you know, our cardiovascular health, our weight, our anxiety, our blood pressure, our stress, or, you know, so I'm not sure that's actually true. I think we've convinced ourselves that it's true. And partly because a lot of the way what I realize is most people don't wake up in the morning meaning to be hateful. They don't aspire to be hateful. Hate tends to be of the they started it variety. So our own hate we see as rational or justified in reaction to the hate of others. And so then it's, oh, we're doing something, I'm being constructive. Maybe then it feels better. But if we step back and look at the sort of cosmic effects as well as the interpersonal effects, it's really not. It's not solving anything. It's not healing. It's not forgiving. It's not evolving. It's just going further down into the mud, and I promise that's neither healthy for people, it's not healthy for our democracy.
Well, Susan couldn't stay with us, and she said she's Christian, and she's uncomfortable with the hatred she feels toward Trump voters in her church. She wants to read your book and learn how to replace that hatred with love. Have we seen an escalation in recent years of hatred, and what does politics have to do with it?
So I actually don't think this is the most hateful period certainly in the United States history. I mean, to be clear, we're a country that was founded on the explicit dehumanization of Native peoples and the eradication of them through what might be considered genocide. We then built up our country on the backs of indentured slave black labor. And for the vast majority of our history, have been fighting tooth and nail to give not only the recognition of equal humanity, but actual equal rights to, you know, women, people of color, immigrants, gay folks, etc. So it's not necessarily that it's as bad as it's ever been. However, I don't think hate has to be the worst it's ever been. for it to be bad enough that we have to do something about it. And I think we can all agree it's pretty bad right now.
Let's bring in Jeremy from Racine with some thoughts on this. Jeremy, hi, go ahead.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I think if we want to put a little bit of a direction on where it's coming from, this year is going to be a very divisive year in regards to politics. It's coming up on midterms. Paul Ryan's not reelected, so you're going to see a mad dash for his seat. You're going to start to see a lot of politics being thrown around and one candidate against another trying to win at all costs, whether it be through political ads, attacking the person's character, history, past. They bring out some pretty raunchy stuff sometimes, and when you get super PACs that are pretty much untethered in, I guess, filtering what they're talking about, you're going to see a lot of that. And you'll notice the change in people's behavior, demeanor, come closer to November, come closer to the elections. We'll start to see a very more higher levels of stress, irritation, things like that. We'll be happy in the summer, but then come election time, you're going to start seeing people change their tone real quick. And it's unfortunate, and I believe a lot of the hatred that we hear about through the media and through election cycles really points to politicians and how they drum up the populace.
Jeremy, thanks so much. Really concerned there about the attack ad avalanche coming in the next months.
Yeah, and you know, the sort of attack ads, mudslinging ads, is an interesting phenomena to understand how we as a country relate to hate. Because on the one hand, poll after poll, American voters say, we don't like those attack ads. We don't like when candidates go negative. And on the other hand, both in our voting patterns and in the ratings we give to media outlets when they cover politics, we show an indication that we actually do prefer the mudslinging and the hate and the attack ads. So there's a little, and I mean, look, that probably resonates with everyone listening, where you're like, yeah, I know what you mean. I don't want them to do it, but when they do it, I sure tune in or click on it to see what's going on.
But there's profitability in that as well.
Of course. Yeah, no, this is a vicious cycle, right, that we're all playing a part in. So the issue is, look, there's no question, right? It is on our leaders. The definition of leaders is not give the people what they think they want. And if they want a mud fight, I'm going to give it to them, right? That's not what leaders do. Leaders do what is morally, politically right and stand on principle. And so it would be good, we should have more leaders who on principle don't do that. Do not make politics into the politics of personal destruction. And at the same time, I'd like to see, by the way, I'm fine with like attack ads that are about policy, attack ads that are about position. Those are great, because then we actually start talking about the real issues that matter in a country instead of just he did this, she did that, blah, 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 blah. The second thing is we as consumers, we as voters have to actually show that we value substance over nastiness in who we vote. And part of the problem is in this last election cycle in 2016, we definitively did not. We showed that as a country, we really like a political candidate who is heavy on hate, heavy on fear-mongering, light on substance, and theatrical in the media sense. And that's what we ended up supporting.
Let's bring in Lisa now, joining us from Janesville. Hi, Lisa. Good morning.
Hi. I've often thought that the 24-hour news cycle plays a role in this. I think the media in general does do a good job. But when you are exposed to something over and over and over again, which a lot of people do watch the news all day or they're in one form or another, it does tend to make things appear to be worse than they are. And if you want to compare that to even like, you know, child abductions, they happen less frequently, but people are more afraid because you hear about it in the media and you hear about the story 4 or 5 times a day. So I think that does play a role.
Lisa, thanks for that. Sally, what do you make of that 24-hour drone of the news cycle?
Look, there's no question that there is, that both media outlets, politicians, online, social media outlets are benefiting from the inflammation of intense and ugly disagreement around politics. There's no question about it, right? We know, as was said during the 2016 election, that maybe Donald Trump is bad for the country, but he is good for ratings. Whatever you think about Donald Trump, you have to look at that. You can look at that kind of clear-eyed and say, well, that's a problem, right? That's a problem if we cover all of the Stormy Daniels stuff and we don't talk about trade policy, right? Because Stormy Daniels is going to get more clicks and more ratings and more, right? And we are not talking about substance. And in a sense, what it ends up being is like, look, we need to be a healthy democracy, to be a healthy citizen, to be a healthy voter, to be an informed person with a healthy plate of news and information that we can then pick from, choose, digest. You need to be served a full menu of news and information. And lately we tend to, serve a lot of salacious dessert. And that's literally and figuratively unhealthy.
Sally Cohn is taking us on a journey to better understand hate. Her new book is called The Opposite of Hate, A Field Guide to Repairing Our Humanity. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a strategy to help yourself see perspectives outside of your own firmly held beliefs? How do you approach feelings of hate inside of you? 800-642-1234. Tweet us at WPR Mornings. Sally, you share this tip in your book for talking with people who might be of a different political belief on the different part of the spectrum. You call it the ABC method. Can you walk us through it?
So what we know from neuroscience is that if people sense an argument, the frontal regions of the brain, the parts that are responsible, involved, the bigger parts, by the way, that are involved in rational thinking and working through a problem and deciding, reasoning, they shut down. And that kind of thinking stops. And the fight or flight mechanisms, the lizard brain, lights up. And people pick a side. And if you're having a conversation with someone you disagree with, and it turns into an argument, or even starts as an argument, then guess what? They are not picking your side. So the first tool when having a conversation with someone who does not agree with you, whatever the reason, the grounds, whatever, if you want to have a constructive conversation, if you want their brain to literally stay on so that they keep listening, first of all, it helps to not shut down your own brain. You have to also be listening to what they're saying, really, truly. And you can't get into an argument. So the ABC trick is, the A in ABC is not argue. Because our tendency is, no, you're wrong. Let me tell you why you're wrong. No, this is that. And you've gotten that wrong. And right? No. Shuts down. Nobody's listening. The A is affirm. Find something that you can understand or at least validate in what the other person's seeing. Often it's a feeling. Because here's the thing. Someone can say, I can be talking to someone in rural Wisconsin, and they can say, I'm really afraid of Muslim terrorism. And I can say, I could like be like, well, that's ridiculous, and blah, 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 blah. And I live in New York, and I'm not as afraid of you. And I can start arguing. And then they're not listening. We're not listening to each other. We're not having a conversation. If instead I recognize that, look, they're feeling afraid. And there's an interesting thing about feelings. Feelings are valid because they're felt. Right? You can't argue with someone's feelings. I learned this in couples counseling, by the way. For instance, if my partner says, you hurt my feelings, I can't say, no, I didn't. Right? They're her feelings. Right. She's in charge of them. If she feels hurt, she's hurt. So same thing. If people feel scared of terrorism or worried about immigrants or whatever, that's how they feel. You can't tell them their feelings are wrong. So instead, if you can find something, yeah, I understand. It is scary when you see these incidents and we don't know where it could happen next. It is frightening that, you know, the economy is so vulnerable and jobs are getting worse and wages are going down. And I feel that too. We affirm. The next, the B is not but. But means everything I said before I didn't really mean. it's also from couples counseling, because if I say, oh, honey, I'm really sorry, but she knows I'm not sorry. You see what I mean? Okay.
How about however?
No, you can't do however. However,
I'm just testing you there, Sally. Just testing.
Thank you. It's the Harvard of buts. No fancy buts either. B is for bridge. You bridge. You say, and that's why, or here's what I think, or here's how I see it, or I'm going to give my perspective, but it's a bridge. It's not a but. And then the C is the content or the convince. It's where you actually say what you want to say, but now have done it in a way, hopefully, that they're listening in a sense that isn't, I disagree with you, I am against you, I am putting my position at odds with yours, but rather I'm hearing your position and I'm talking about my position in the context of your position. We're relating to each other. We're parsing through the same, we're on the same side trying to figure out our concerns and hopes and dreams together.
Well, what
it's
might
a
be
very
the,
different conversation.
Yeah, what might be the difficult part of that is actually listening, to be able to stay in the moment, to hear, to really hear, because we're always two steps ahead or we're not completely focused.
Or we tend to think we know what someone's going to say because we've kind of decided which side they're on, which I see a lot of, right? Is someone on my quote unquote side, however I define that, you know, they're a liberal, they're a New Yorker, they're gay like me, they, you know, shop at the same grocery store I shop at, they say something and I don't even maybe think that critically about it. I give it a pass. Same thing, my politician, the person I voted for, the person I supported. Someone on the other side, however that's defined, rival town, rival state, different race, different religion, you know, they say or do the same thing, and I'm outraged, completely outraged. And there's a very fancy scientific word for that. It's called hypocrisy. And the problem is we're often prejudging, right? Part of the nature of hate is that we are quick to jump to hating certain groups of people, and whereas giving a pass to the problematic things that people on our own side do.
Different thresholds with different people, different groups.
Yeah.
CNN political commentator Sally Cohn is taking us on a journey to better understand hate, how to deal with it in our world. After the 2016 election, she found her anger intensifying, and so she traveled. She traveled around to talk with people outside of her New York bubble, outside of her comfort zone, in this attempt to understand the origins of hate. Her new book is called The Opposite of Hate, A Field Guide to Repairing Our Humanity. We're talking about it here on The Morning Show. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a certain strategy, a certain tact to help yourself see perspectives outside of your own firmly held beliefs? Maybe you have an ABC. How do you approach feelings of hate? Where do you see hate creep into your life? Let's talk about it. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. We'll rejoin the conversation after the latest news here on the Ideas Network. CNN's Sally Cohn writes that her own hate is always oozing out in unexpected ways, big and small. She's being completely honest here, that she doesn't have all the answers, other than that, metaphorically speaking, she needed to turn on the light and start noticing things different to try to be different. We're talking with Sally Cohn on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Her new book is The Opposite of Hate, A Field Guide to Repairing Our Humanity. And you can join in the conversation at 800-642-1234. Have you turned on the light in your own life? How have you been enlightened about hate? Call in, tweet us, WPR Mornings. Let's go to Sandy now, joining us from Walworth. Hi, Sandy.
Hi, good morning. Just a little bit of a question. I was wondering if you could discuss the difference, if there is one, between hate and dislike.
Oh, I have no problem with dislike. You could, you can dislike me, you can dislike people. Now, where it gets hard, where it gets challenging, is if we get into groups of people. Right. And if dislike becomes a soft way of expressing hate, right? I don't hate, I'm Jewish. So, like, if someone said to me, oh, I don't hate Jewish people, I just dislike them. Well, yeah, but is that like just we're trying to make it seem like we don't hate, right? So it kind of, it depends on what's underneath it. You know, I will say, though, as a sort of antidote to all of, to this question, that in my book, The Opposite of Hate, it's not love. You don't have to love people to not hate them. And by the way, you don't have to like people even to not hate them. What you have to do is, what we all have to do is understand how we are fundamentally deeply connected as human beings, and that others have the same right to grace and forgiveness and kindness and compassion and humanity that we ourselves believe we and our kin deserve too. So in that sense, it's that's the thing, is connection and getting to know people becomes the antidote to hate.
Sandy, thanks for the call. Let's go to Courtney now in Viroqua. Hi, Courtney.
Hey there. I just want to say this is a really important subject that I've been thinking about probably several years ever since my family started having different political views than me. And so the way that I see it is this is kind of a fear-based reaction that people have coming from, you know, quote, the lizard brain, which your guest was speaking about. And one thing that's really helped me is this seminar called the Landmark Forum. It's in Chicago and all around the world. And it basically, it moved me from more of the lizard brain, like fear reaction, to understanding that nobody's wrong. Like when I'm talking to somebody, everybody has a story, just like you're saying, you know, everybody has feelings. Those feelings are never wrong. So that opened up for me. And also what opened up is a method of curious listening where, you know, when I'm talking to someone, just being very conscious of, like, when I'm listening, am I putting my opinion in between what they're saying and what I'm hearing? So when I'm conscious of that, it allows me to actually hear what they say and ask questions about it and be curious and put them off of their, it doesn't, they're not on guard. People aren't on guard. So it's an easier, it's just a formula that I use for, you know, when I'm talking to someone that I don't agree with, if I really open up and show them, if I actually do care about them and what they're saying, it's a good method.
Courtney, thanks. Yeah. Sally, the curious listener.
I love that. I mean, one of the things I realized pretty early on when I was at Fox News, is still true now at CNN, is you can't talk to someone and hope that they're going to listen and be potentially transformed by what you're saying if you're not also listening to them and going to be potentially transformed by what they're saying. And I catch myself still. I realize I do this thing where, you know, if I'm set up, the way we set TV up is there's someone on this side and I'm on the other side and we're supposed to be arguing. And so there's this knee-jerk thing, like we're all trained to do, where if they make a point, I'm supposed to argue with it. I'm supposed to make the opposite point. I'm supposed to disagree. And if I'm really listening, I love Courtney's phrase, curiously listening, then sometimes I realize I don't disagree with what they're saying. Or I don't 100% disagree. I disagree with a little bit. And there's more nuance and there's more, right? Instead of just sort of saying, okay, since you're my enemy, everything you say I disagree with, and right? And that is actually incredibly constructive. We have to all be, if we want others to listen to us, we have to listen to them. It's a very important starting place.
I want to ask you about your experience talking with a former Palestinian terrorist who's now working to try to achieve peace in the Middle East. Can you tell us about his story, his path away from hate?
Yeah, it's so one of the things I did for the book was travel around the world to hear these stories of people whose lives had been transformed, who had left the most extreme edges of hate and walked away and changed their whole hearts and minds. And it just, I thought, well, if they could do it, there must be something they can teach us and the rest of us who are grappling with far less intense versions of hate. So one of the places I went was to Israel-Palestine because it is such, they call it an intractable conflict, as though it is hopeless. There is no chance of anything but hate. And met there a man named Bassam Araman, who, when he was a teenager, was convicted of terrorism, actually for an act where he wasn't physically present at the bombing. No one was injured. It was a bunch of kids throwing a grenade, not knowing what they were doing. But he intended. He was sent to prison. And in prison, he was shown a film about the Holocaust that just broke him wide open. He broke down crying, changed his whole understanding of Israelis and Jews, afterwards got a master's degree in Holocaust studies, and went on to start a peace organization of former Israeli combatants and former Palestinian combatants working together for common understanding and common humanity. It's amazing.
In writing this book, who else challenged your assumptions about hate? Who else changed you?
I have to say, quite selfishly, I had a transformational experience just writing this book and hearing these stories. And I mean, it's everything from people who, through showing kindness and compassion in the face of hate online, changed people's lives for the better, to going to Rwanda, which was the site of the world's fastest genocide, 800,000 people killed in 100 days in 1994, and sitting with a woman in her home who is a Tutsi, who had invited her Hutu neighbor, who she calls her friend, into her home, sitting next to him, serving him tea. This man having been the man who massacred her husband and children, and watching her have this talk to and be graceful and forgiving. I don't know if I could do that. I don't know I have the capacity for that. Took my breath away. It showed me both the incredible atrocity and heinousness that human beings are capable of, and also our profound capacity for understanding, caring, compassion, connection, blew my mind away.
Let's go to Jennifer in Madison. Jennifer, hi.
Hi. So I just wanted to, there's a question here, bear with me. So right now, I think as a society, we're questioning the idea of what is socially prescribed discourse, and it's very male. And so the idea, like in the Me Too movement and something like that, is that fundamentally you're dehumanizing someone else, and it may not be a conscious choice, but through your actions and trying to meet your own needs, you're not even viewing someone else as a human being and giving them their rights. And it almost in some ways seems more like indifference versus a conscious choice to hate. Can you talk about that in terms of, because some of what you're talking about is more a sort of what is considered a more socially prescribed feminine way of approaching things, I think. And so I wonder if you could comment about that, like conscious choice to be hateful versus indifference and sort of dehumanizing someone else for your own needs.
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. I don't tend to think of it in in sort of those gendered terms, in part because I'm on the more gender nonconforming end of things myself. So I have half the internet thinking I'm a man, and here I'm writing a book that some might say is conventionally feminine. So I get all confused very easily. I will say this much that I think that relates to your question, which is we have, I think, as a, by and large, and we're still wrestling with it, obviously, including in this moment with this president's move, but we, by and large, gotten to the point where we think we know explicit hatred, explicit bigotry, explicit sexism, and misogyny are wrong and shameful and are socially shamed and culturally shamed. And the tension now, or the challenge now, is how do we talk about, surface, and address the unconscious forms, the ways that it's harder to point to, and yet that in so many ways have a more insidious impact. The you know, acts of sexual harassment, sexual assault are overt, and thankfully are being called out more, seen more, and taken action. Actions like, or acts like women not being in management structures, women being paid less, women being just treated as less worthy for promotions. The very fact that women are hired based on experience, whereas men are hired on their potential, that women's names on resumes are more likely to get callbacks than men's names on the same exact resume. That, by and large, isn't about that explicit bigotry and hatred. It's about unconscious sexism, unconscious misogyny. And until we also all can acknowledge that is a problem and that is wrong, then it's very, it's hard for, there are things we can do about it, but we have to start seeing that as part of this puzzle.
Well, Sally Cohn, thank you so much for spending time with us.
This was really wonderful. Thank you so much for having me.
Sally Cohn is a columnist and political commentator for CNN. Her new book is called The Opposite of Hate, A Field Guide to Repairing Our Humanity. This hour, The Morning Show was produced by Chris Molina and Colleen Leahy. Michelle Johnson is executive producer and provided technical direction. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and this conversation about hate, you found it on the Ideas Network.